Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
And welcome to Catholic Answers Live. It's Tuesday, and that means open forum, open forum. Any questions you've got, maybe on the Catholic sacraments, the life of Jesus, the Pope, Lent, Easter, anything having to do with Catholic life or faith, or the life of religion more generally, happy to take those calls. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. I am your host, Cy Kellett. Our guest this hour, Jimmy Akin. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy. I thought I was Tim Staples for a second.
That we should have done that. We should have pretended you were Tim Staples.
Yeah. And then you just morphed into Jimmy Akin.
Yeah.
One of those cheesy special effects.
Tim grew a beard.
Yeah.
Jimmy Akin, in case you don't know, is, I know you know, I'm looking at you while I'm saying this, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author, among many other things, of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist.
Right. Yeah.
And are you working on the sequel yet?
I've actually done some work in that direction. I haven't formally put my hand to the plow, but I have some notes and some preliminary things for more than one sequel potentially, actually. One of them that I want to do is going to be a 365-day book where each day explains something from the Bible.
And I think
that'd be really cool.
Oh, I was thinking it would be more apologetics books, but it would be 365 days on other things like the Bible.
Yeah, so I think there's also – I probably have A Daily Defense Volume 2 in me, which would all be apologetics again. But then I have additional things like 365 days on the Bible and stuff like that.
Yeah. So. You like the Bible.
I like it a lot.
I noticed that about you. Yeah. You spend a lot of time on the Bible.
Thinking about it too.
Yeah. Yeah. You should – sometime, have you ever thought about doing this, like a daily Bible show? I think you would be great at it.
You know the answer to that question.
Well, maybe I was asking as if I'm the listener. Sometimes that's my position.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see. We'll let people wonder about that.
So ask Jimmy that. 888-318-7884. All right. I got a question for you from A Daily Defense. I just picked it.
I don't know what this is. You and I have never worked together before.
Well, we have worked together
before. The magic is real.
But yeah. Okay. Here we go. Now, why – oh, I'm supposed to read this in kind of a fussy voice. Why should I believe anything that can't be verified by science?
Because not everything can be verified by science. Science involves the use of what's called the scientific method. And in the scientific method, you make certain observations of a phenomenon, and then you theorize what may be responsible for those observations in such a way that you can make a prediction, and then you run an experiment to test and see whether your prediction is fulfilled. But there are lots of things that methodology doesn't work for. For example, does your wife love you? Well, if you start experimenting on your wife, she's probably not going to love you too much.
I get in trouble every time.
Yeah, it's kind of like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle where the observer effect interferes with the phenomenon.
Right.
Yeah, same thing happens in love. There are lots of other things, though, that can't be scientifically verified, like the laws of mathematics. Those are not verified by experiment. Those are verified
by
in
logic.
A different way. Yeah. So same thing with laws of logic. And guess what? Scientific method itself. How can you use a scientific experiment to show that scientific method is reliable? And the answer is you can't, because scientific method is not itself based on observation. It involves a set of principles that we found to be useful, but there's no way you can make scientific method itself the study of empirical observation and testing. And so consequently, there are a lot of areas in life that science is incapable of addressing. And so while it's been a very useful tool for investigating many areas in the world, it's not a comprehensive one that you can rely on to drive your entire belief system. In fact, if you tried that, it would undermine itself.
And there's 365 of these?
Yeah.
Or were you just
– six, actually, 365.
Oh, that's right, 365 plus one.
Yeah.
And why don't you say 356? Because so many years only have 365 days?
Well, this is where we get into the publisher versus author side of things.
Oh.
Because titles and subtitles are officially decided by the publisher, not the author. And so
in this case, the publisher is some outfit called Catholic Answers Press.
Yeah, I know. And if I had been designing the subtitle, I might have done it a little differently, but it's functions and it hasn't stopped the book from being really, really popular.
I didn't know I was getting into an area of contention there. I actually
be
really like
what
reading.
You ask for.
Yeah, so I'm going to stop asking you questions until I know the answer. Actually, I just asked you a question that I know the answer
to. You know
to,
the answer to.
And you didn't answer it. 888-318-7884 is the number. We are taking any question you've got on the life of faith, any question you've got on any issue having to do with religion. It is open forum on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy, how about we go and straight to calls?
Let's do.
All right. Chris in England is not ready yet.
Oh.
Ryan?
Let's try Ryan in Michigan.
In
maybe?
Michigan. Ryan in Michigan listening on AM 990. You are on with Jimmy Akin. It's open forum. What's your question?
My question has to do with the doctrine of total depravity.
Okay.
So in the fifth canon of the Council of Trent, it says, if any man says that after the sin of Adam, man's free will was extinguished, let him be anathema. Mm-hmm. And also, in the Council of Trent, it affirms prevenient grace. John 6:44, no man can come to the Son unless the Father who sent him draws him.
Right.
And I will raise him up on the last day. And so, I was a little confused because if I can't come to the Son unless the Father draws me, then it seems like my free will is extinguished. So it seems like the Council of Trent's fifth canon is both contradicting itself and John 6:44. So I was wondering why that's not a contradiction.
Okay. There are several ways of looking at this, and one of them is to recognize that when Trent says that man's free will was not extinguished by the fall, it doesn't mean that it wasn't damaged by the fall. Something can be damaged but not extinguished. And in the case of the Council of Trent, what they were dealing with were some viewpoints that were being entertained in various circles, particularly in the Protestant community, that either denied that man had ever had any kind of free will, that just everything we do is we're like robots, you know, we're wind up, God's wind up toys, and never had free will of any kind. And then there was a kind of mitigated form that said, well, okay, maybe we had free will before the fall of man, but then when Adam sinned, we completely lost it, and now our wills are wholly bound to sin so that we don't have any freedom, and the only way we can do anything good at all, if we can do anything good at all, is if God causes us to do it, so we don't have free will. And that's what Trent is reacting against. So it's not reacting against the idea that our free will wasn't damaged. Trent's perfectly happy to say that our free will was damaged, but we still actually retain freedom. We don't have a complete lack of freedom. So that's one way of reconciling these two things. You could say, well, so maybe our free will was damaged in such a way that we couldn't come to God unless he gives us prevenient grace, which is the grace that enables us to respond positively to God's message. So we couldn't come to him in that sense unless God gives us this grace to compensate for the damage that was done to our free will by the fall. But there's another way of looking at it too, which would be to say this. Man doesn't automatically have what theologians call a supernatural vocation. That is, a vocation to be with God and in spiritual union with him. God could have created man in what theologians refer to as a state of pure nature. In a state of pure nature, we wouldn't have sin, but we also wouldn't have the grace of being spiritually united with God. We might know certain things about God that we could tell by natural reason, like the fact that he exists, but we wouldn't have the supernatural desire in our hearts to be in union with him. And so that's another way of looking at this. You could say, well, in order for us to have that desire for spiritual union with God, it requires a gift from God. It requires that just like he gave us free will in the beginning, he also needs to give us the gift, which is a kind of free will, to desire union with him spiritually. And that's an elevated thing above simply natural free will. It's a kind of supernaturalized freedom where we have the desire and the ability to pursue those desires to have union with God, which is something he didn't have to offer us. It's a grace. He could have created us in a paradisical environment with no sin and no suffering, but he just didn't bring us into full spiritual union with himself. That's a gift. And so that's another way that you could look at how the existence of free will squares with the fact that we need God's grace in order to come to him.
Okay. I'm still wondering about that, the specific mm-hmm. ability to come to the Father without him drawing you. I mean, you don't have the free will to do that, you know?
Correct, but there are a lot of things that I don't have the ability. When we talk about free will, I think you may be thinking of some kind of unlimited freedom, and that's not what's meant by saying we have free will. There are lots of things I can't choose. Not being Spider-Man, I can't choose to crawl on the walls. You know, not being Superman, I can't choose to fly. But there are a lot of things that are within the scope of things that I can choose. And so I have free will with respect to those things that I can choose. I'm not just a puppet. That's what's meant when we say someone has free will. We don't mean there aren't things that they're incapable of choosing. We mean that they do have freedom within whatever scope of freedom they have. And so that's one of the things that applies here. In terms of the ability to choose God, there's also the fact that God ensures that everybody has the grace needed to come to him. This is something the Second Vatican Council teaches, that even if it's in a mysterious way, in ways known to God, he can make it possible and does make it possible for everybody to come to him. So it's by his grace that that happens. But he ensures that that grace is given to everybody.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Thank you, Ryan. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Call now. Tim is waiting to speak with you. Widely regarded as the premier magazine of Catholic apologetics and evangelization, our award-winning Catholic Answers magazine features the articles you want by the authors you know and respect. Year after year, Catholic Answers magazine has been bringing the very best teachers the Catholic world has to offer into thousands of homes on a regular basis. Top-notch writers like Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, Mark Brumley, Tim Staples, Carlo Brissard, and Matt Nelson. The list goes on and on. It makes a perfect gift for family and friends, students, priests, and seminarians. Just about anybody you know. And of course, don't forget about a subscription for yourself. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to shop.catholic.com to subscribe today. Share the faith. Defend the faith. Catholic Answers Magazine from Catholic Answers, the most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 23, Jesus warned his disciples to observe all that the scribes and Pharisees told them to do, but not to follow their example. He acknowledged their authority, but took great exception to their behavior, referring to their self-absorption and penchant for places and terms of honor. So he warned them about seeking titles of teacher or father. He by no means was suggesting that they stop using such titles for those to whom such titles belonged. Scripture shows us that in themselves, such titles have their place. St. Paul called himself the father of those he shepherded. The context here was that of Jesus warning against pride and of being on guard against self-seeking. Such warnings are still appropriate. St. Catherine of Siena was one day to tell the Lord, "My me is you," so centered was she on him. This is what he deserves from all of us. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Thanks for being with us today on Catholic Answers Live. It is open forum, and Jimmy Akin is here to take your questions. And I say this with some nervousness.
But first,
Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers.
Si, I make you nervous?
Well, I'm nervous about one thing, and I don't know. Should I explain what that thing is?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I
don't know. Can we talk about it on the air?
I think so. See, I was joking around saying – I was saying to certain people who are working on the cruise that I was going to come in here, and every time that I promoted the cruise, I was going to say, and Si Kellett is going, and I was going to say it so much that it would be false advertising if you didn't let me go.
And then
they said, well, if you get – 20 people to go on the cruise, you can go on the cruise.
Yes.
And no one ever said whether they checked with Chris Check about this. So I had no idea so now that you're here, I'm...
Well, that would be in keeping with many of the things that go on at this apostolate.
I don't believe that.
So I think we're getting close, Si. But right, I do want to encourage people to sign up and so that we can bring Si with us. And in order to take advantage of that, when you go to CatholicAnswersCruise.com, enter the word Si.
C-Y.
C-Y is how you spell that. Yeah. Not S-I-G-H.
No, some people do spell it that way.
Yes. Oh, come on.
So enter the word Si and get the code. And if you do sign up with that Si code, then you get a free shore excursion when we go to Halifax, which is going to include Mass at St. Mary's Basilica and a visit to one of the best maritime museums in North America. A lunch, and then the famous lighthouse there at Peggy's Cove. But the whole trip is going to be great. And I just learned why Tim Staples is not here to do the hour.
Why is that?
Because he's out shopping for cruise wear.
Oh,
for this cruise. Yeah.
Just for Tim Staples fans, that's not actually true. That's a little humorous.
I think
to
people
lift
knew
the mood
that
at Tim's expense.
If you don't show up, then we get to say stuff at your expense.
That's right.
That's one of the rules.
Yeah. No, we'll see. Well, next time he's on, we'll ask him to model his cruise wear. So I'll be going, and Tim Staples, Patrick Madrid from the Patrick Madrid Show on Immaculate Heart Radio, my brother, Father Paul Check, formerly of Courage, now the rector of the seminary in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and a Canadian priest, Father Michael Eads from the Toronto Oratory, who's really a very first-rate priest. And we've had to bring a second priest because we're up to about 175 people for this. So we want to get to 200 folks. This is going to be a wonderful cruise. Montreal, Quebec City, Charlottesville, Sydney, Halifax, Bar Harbor, Boston, the church in the New World. We'll be talking about all the great history there in French Canada and in North America, but also some of the strange religions that came out of this region. I know Patrick Madrid, I think, is going to talk about, you know, how to talk to Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons. Tim's going to go into some of that history of Cardinal Gibbons and Americanism, the Seventh-day Adventist, a lot of really great apologetics and history and spiritual direction on this cruise. And we're
hoping
fairly certain
Si will be
Si Kellett is going
to
join
us. You forgot to add the other – if you put the code Si in there, I also carry your bags onto and off the ship. Did you know that that's
– I think that's great. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of
them. That's only for the people who put that code in.
Yeah, right. You could find out more by calling the Cruise Authority at 800-707-1634, 800-707-1634, or visit CatholicAnswersCruise.com.
CatholicAnswersCruise.com. And we will get to a point where we run out of cabins. I don't think we're there yet. In fact,
you can't just build new ones on the side of the ship or something?
I think we could tow people behind dinghy or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Makes for a much less pleasant cruise.
But
though,
the view is great.
Awesome. Yeah.
Right. CatholicAnswersCruise.com. Look forward to seeing you folks there. God bless.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, gentlemen.
I'm so glad it's official now. I didn't know Chris knew, so
okay.
I feel much better.
Oh, good.
How about we go back? Oh, Chris from England. We had to wait on Chris.
A different Chris.
I believe
awesome.
Chris from England is ready now. Chris from England listening on the Catholic Answers app. You are on with Jimmy Akin on Open Forum.
And I have a question for you. What part of England are you in?
I'm from Manchester.
Manchester. Okay, very good. Awesome. Great to hear from you.
Thank you. So my question is that we have the belief that the Holy Spirit is the primary author of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would like to know, how can we account for apparent factual contradictions? One story comes to mind of the demon-possessed man in the Gospel of Mark and also in the Gospel of Matthew. Mm-hmm. In the Gospel of Matthew, there's two possessed men,
mm-hmm.
and also The location seems to be different from the same story from the Gospel of Mark. And so how can we account for these seeming factual contradictions?
Okay. The incident you're referring to is it's described in one place as the Gadarene demoniac, because Jesus is in the area of Gadara. And so there are a couple of things to note here, because you've asked about the location and about the number of the possessed man. One of the things that we find in Scripture is that the location terms often overlap. So you can describe, because they didn't have, you know, geolocation coordinates back then. Geocaching was not a big thing in the first century. And so you could describe locations in a variety of different ways. Sometimes you could describe them based on where they were in terms of the region that they're in. Sometimes you could describe them in terms of what town they were close to. Sometimes you could describe them in terms of how you got there. Sometimes you could describe them in terms of what features geographically were nearby. And so there were a bunch of ways that you could more or less describe the same area. And because they weren't, you know, trying to geocache these things, you could say, well, this happened in this region or in this approximate area. And different authors can take different approaches to how they do that. And so that's how I would account for the difference in location descriptions that you find in Matthew and Mark, both of whom have a version of this incident. If you'd like to read more about that, I'd suggest you check out my commentary on Mark, which is called Mark, a Commentary, by Jimmy Akin, and it's available on Verbum Bible software. It's actually really thorough commentary, and I go through that question among others in this. Also, I go into the question of the number of the demoniacs, and that is one that's actually easier even to solve, because one of the things that authors have to make a decision when they're writing, and this is true of all authors, certainly I know it's true of me when I'm writing, is how much detail are you going to go into? Because frequently you know way more about something than you have space to go into, either because you've gotten a word count from your editor that you have to meet, or you're going to run out of paper, or you simply don't want to bore your audience so they lose interest and stop reading and you're writing for no purpose. So every author is conscious of how much detail am I going to go into here. And therefore, authors make different choices. They may choose, for example, to simplify an account in terms of how many of the details they record. Like, suppose something happened with two guys, but they're both demoniacs, they both get exorcised by Jesus, they're both in the same location. Do I really need to mention both, or can I just make, as an author, the point that, okay, Jesus exorcised a demoniac here? And that's the choice that Mark makes when Mark only mentions one. He's using a simplified account. Now, in Mark's case, he may not have been the one who did the simplification, because Mark is dependent in his gospel on Peter's preaching. And so if Peter in his preaching simply decided, I'm going to talk for the sake of my audience about one guy rather than confuse him with two, then that could have been the form of the account that Mark was familiar with. And so that's the one he wrote down. But either way, either Peter or Mark is simplifying. Matthew, also as an eyewitness, would have known, well, okay, there is, assuming he was there for this incident, assuming, you know, he wasn't taking the day off and that he was already a follower of Jesus by this point. But as a witness of Jesus' ministry, he could have well been there, and he could have said, you know, there were actually two guys there, and I think that'll suit my literary purposes in helping my audience in writing my gospel. So I'm not going to use the simplified account I found in Mark. I'm going to give a little bit more detail than Mark did and mention the second guy. So that's the basic approach that I'd take in looking at those. It's not actually a contradiction. It's just a question of how much detail are you going to go into, and different authors make different choices.
Chris.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. By the way, I have entries on both of these in my book, A Daily Defense. And being in England, the easiest way for you to get that might be on amazon.co.uk, where it's available in Kindle.
Thank you very much for that. Chris, we got to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum today. Any question you've got on the life or faith of the Catholic Church, any question you've got on the moral life or religious life more generally, we welcome those calls. 888-318-7884. We'll be right back.
We're ready and waiting for your call today on Catholic Answers Live. We hear it every year, the perennial question, what are you giving up for Lent? And there's nothing wrong with doing without certain things you may have an affinity for. But this year, why not turn the question around and ask, what are you taking on for Lent? Did you know that by investing as little as 5 minutes a day, you can take on a Lenten practice that will both build up and inform your faith? A Daily Defense is the perfect book for your Lenten journey. Jimmy Akin takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Make this Lent one to remember. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What do the Pharisees, pagan emperors, the Nazis, and the Quran all have in common? All were enemies of the faith who admitted crucial facts that undermined their own position. In his new book, Hostile Witnesses, How the Historic Enemies of the Church Prove Christianity, author Gary Machuda looks at dozens of Christianity's most notorious foes, from biblical times through the 20th century, and draws from their words and deeds surprising testimony to gospel truths. Rich in research and written with clarity and force, Hostile Witnesses is a unique contribution to Catholic apologetics, one that speaks with special urgency to a modern world in which the faith is once again under attack. If you love apologetics, you need to order your copy of Hostile Witnesses today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore in your area.
Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum. That means Jimmy's happy to take, I think you're happy, to take.
I'm very happy.
You are?
Yeah.
To take any question on the life, faith of the Catholic.
So this is a specialized form of happiness.
Yeah, you're happy to.
Okay.
Like, it would be happy if they.
I'm happy in general, but I'm also happy in this specialized sense you're talking about.
Let's see if John in Louisville. Oh, wait. First of all, I should give out the number. 888-318-7884 is the number. That's 888-31-TRUTH. We now go to John in Louisville, Kentucky, listening on Sirius Radio. John, you are on with Jimmy Akin. What's your question?
Hi, Jimmy. Hi. How are you guys?
Just fine.
Okay. So I'm in a Christian scripture, which is the title of the course for a certificate of pastoral ministry.
Okay. And I was also going to say, sounds like you're in a car, but okay.
Or a wind tunnel.
Is your Christian course with you in the car?
And I'm not. No, I'm not doing both at the same time.
Okay.
Does the car have windows?
Most cars do so.
Go ahead and roll them up. Sorry. Okay. All right, John, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have bothered you. Go ahead.
Not at all. So, first of all, is the John the apostle whom Jesus loved, and John the author of the gospel, and John of Patmos all the same John?
It's a very interesting question, and the church doesn't have a teaching here. This is not a matter of doctrine or dogma. It's something on which Catholics can have different opinions, and that's something that Pope Benedict actually talked about. If you read his discussions about this, he gave, for example, some audiences on the Joannine literature in the New Testament, which you can look up on the Vatican's website. He also talked about the Joannine literature in Volume 1 of his Jesus of Nazareth series. And one of the things that he discusses is the fact that this literature doesn't lock us down into a single option regarding who is exactly who. And he says at one point that it was evidently the intent of the author to leave the matter shrouded in mystery, to use his phrase. Having said that, there are some clues we can use to try to figure it out. Now, one of the things I need to kind of separate is the John, the disciple who Jesus loved. You mentioned that as one of the options. Actually, there's a question there. Is John the disciple that is referred to, John the Apostle, the disciple that Jesus loved in the Gospel of John? It's kind of tangled to say it that way, but there's a question. Yeah. Is John, son of Zebedee, the beloved disciple? And there's an argument that he is. One of the things that and it's been put various ways, but one of the things you find out when you read the Gospel of John and you're being attentive to the clues is that the author is apparently someone who has intimate access to Jesus. He because he's described as the disciple that Jesus loved. Now, that could be kind of literary artifice, because you could say, well, Jesus loves all of his disciples, and the beloved disciple felt loved by Jesus, and so he's mentioning himself this way as a way of emphasizing Jesus' love without saying Jesus didn't also love other people in the same way. Or it may mean, no, Jesus had a special affection for him. So both of those are possibilities. But he does seem to have intimate access to Jesus, because at the Last Supper, he's the one who's seated closest to Jesus, closer even than St. Peter. Now, some people have said, okay, well, if he's a close disciple of Jesus, that would put him in the 12, and it would also put him presumably in the core group of the 12, which was like Peter, Andrew, James, and John. And, well, he can't be Peter, because he's just distinguished himself from Peter, because Peter is seated farther away at the Last Supper. He wouldn't be Andrew either, because he's keeping his name quiet throughout the gospel. He's deliberately not identifying himself. And he does identify Andrew early on. And so it wouldn't be Andrew. That would leave James and John, the son of Zebedee. But we know from the end of John's gospel, there was a rumor that this John would not die. Well, guess what? James, son of Zebedee, died in like AD 42, 43. And so there was no rumor about him that survived about he's not going to die. So if it is one of the four core disciples, then John would be the one who's left. So there's an argument that John, son of Zebedee, is the beloved disciple. There's also an argument that he's not. One of the things you find when you read in the Church Fathers is there's another disciple, also known as John, who was an eyewitness of Jesus's ministry. He was not one of the apostles, but he was an eyewitness, and he's known as John the Elder. And some early Christian sources, including St. Jerome, attribute at least some of the Joannine books in the New Testament to this John the Elder. Specifically, they will attribute 2nd and 3rd John to the Elder, because they're not addressed from – it doesn't say at the beginning, from John to so-and-so. It says from the Elder to so-and-so. And a number of early Christian sources say, okay, that's who's writing these. It's not John the Apostle. It's John the Elder. And actually, that's the position that Pope Benedict also took, that those, at least those two books were written by John the Elder. What's the relationship then between John the Apostle and John the Elder? Well, they're two different guys. They apparently were both buried at Ephesus. That's one of the things that we're told by early Christian sources, and that could give rise to confusion between the two. If you have two guys who were both eyewitnesses of Jesus, both named John, and they're both buried in Ephesus, it's easy to see how people could get the two of them mixed up. And so that could be part of what's going on in our struggle to figure out who wrote exactly what in the New Testament. In terms of the argument that John, the author of John's gospel, might be somebody other than John the Apostle, there are some interesting points. One point is that even though he's not identified by his first name, John the Apostle is mentioned in the Gospel of John. He's mentioned as one of the two sons of Zebedee when they go to the Sea of Galilee. And so there's a kind of a minor argument that if he's really trying to keep his identity secret, why would he mention himself that way? It seems more likely that the beloved disciple is one of the two completely unnamed disciples who was there on that occasion. Also, whenever you look at where this disciple appears in the Gospel of John, he tends to appear, with a few exceptions, he tends to appear in Jerusalem. he doesn't seem to be following Jesus on a regular basis through Galilee. He seems to be a native of Jerusalem. He also seems to be an upper-class, aristocratic, and likely priestly resident of Jerusalem because the high priest knows him personally. When Jesus has been betrayed and they're taking him to the house of the high priest to interrogate Jesus, John is immediately given access because the servant girl who's keeping the door knows him because the high priest knows him. So he's a familiar person in the household of the high priest. This is very unlikely for a Galilean fisherman. And in fact, we know that because she doesn't know Peter. She keeps him out, and John has to go and get Peter brought in, which he again does because he's known in the household of the high priest. So that could suggest he's an aristocratic inhabitant of Jerusalem who may himself belong to the priestly class if he's on a first-name basis with the high priest. Also, there's a question of why would John the Apostle be seated higher than Peter at the Last Supper? Because that's the kind of thing that's going to provoke some dissension. And if he's one of the apostles and he's being seated higher than Peter, that's going to cause confusion. So maybe there's another explanation why someone would be seated next to Jesus on that occasion. And a very plausible answer that's been proposed is he was the house owner. Because if your host is there at the Last Supper, it would be natural to seat the host next to the guest of honor. And it would make sense to have, therefore, John of Jerusalem, if we want to call him that, seated next to Jesus and Peter in second place. So could, and this is a proposal some have entertained, could the Zebedees have owned a property in Jerusalem that then became the site of the Last Supper? So maybe John, son of Zebedee, could have been seated there as kind of the son of the house owner and thus the representative of the family. Well, it's possible they could have owned a house in Jerusalem, but here's the problem with that. If you look in the Synoptic Gospels, and specifically if you look in Luke, Jesus sends two of his disciples to find a representative of this household to arrange for them to have the Last Supper there. And he tells them, you know, go find a guy who's carrying water on his head, and then he's going to lead you back to this house and tell the householder, we want to have the Passover here. Well, guess what two disciples he sends? In Luke, it's Peter and John. And so it would, if this was John's house, it wouldn't make a lot of sense to send John to go find this servant with the water jar and go back and ask the householder. Jesus would just say, John, let's have it at your place. So there's an interesting argument to be made that maybe the beloved disciple is a different John. That's also and there are also hybrid solutions. Now, we know the beloved disciple is the author of this gospel because he identifies himself as such late in the gospel. Some have proposed a kind of hybrid solution. For example, if you look at what Pope Benedict wrote in Jesus of Nazareth, his proposal is that the beloved disciple is John, son of Zebedee, but that the gospel in its final form was written by John the Elder. So there's a kind of hybrid possibility there. Other people, like the scholar Richard Baucom, have thought that it was John the Elder who wrote the gospel. Others have said, well, maybe Revelation was written by John the Elder. That was a position favored by the church historian Eusebius in the 400s or 300s, the 4th century. And there are other solutions yet. So the church doesn't have a teaching on this. It's something that is a very interesting question to explore. The majority opinion has been that John the Apostle wrote all this stuff. But what's important is not specifically the historical individual that wrote it, but that it's both historically reliable and, more importantly, divinely inspired. And as long as that's guaranteed, people can discuss and have different opinions about who precisely the inspired author was.
Does that help you, John?
Right. Sure does. Thank you. I wish I had about 5 months with you, but you know, I don't. So.
But you can go at some point, maybe.
But you can go to Catholic.com and listen to this show again if you like. It's there. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin taking your questions today for Open Forum. Be right back.
Hey everyone, Carlo Broussard here, and I want to let you know about a very special event that you're going to want to save the date for. This September 28th to 30th, we'll be hosting our fourth annual National Apologetics Conference here in beautiful San Diego, and this is one conference you don't want to miss. The theme is the reunion of all Christians, and we've got an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to fire you up. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf, apologist Mark Brumley, apologist Devin Rose, plus all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. For almost four decades, Catholic Answers has been engaging our separated brethren in charity to bring them to the fullness of the truth. Join us this September for a lively and inspiring conference designed to help you play an active part in the reunion of all Christians. We've got lower prices than ever before and a beautiful venue in San Diego, California. You don't want to miss it. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Call 1-888-291-8000 today to register or visit CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, and thank you to everybody who, in addition to maybe all those who are listening on via radio and other means, those of you who are watching on YouTube Live, Facebook Live, or Periscope, we're very grateful to have you as viewers as well as listeners. And you know, you can always go, and those things are archived. So
yeah.
if you want to see a show later.
Yeah.
Want to see what Jimmy Akin was wearing today or
that's always interesting.
I could describe it.
You could.
But I don't know how successful I would be. But
that's okay.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you want to go specifically to the Jimmy Akin stuff, you could go to youtube.com/JimmyAkin because I'm putting it in my YouTube channel.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Philip on YouTube. Jimmy, watching on YouTube, typed in the following question. So
okay.
it's not a call, but did the Blessed Mother know she was free from original sin?
Well, she wouldn't have used that term to articulate it because that term is something that took centuries to develop. The term original sin is one of those terms like purgatory or Trinity or Bible that is it in itself post-biblical. It describes a biblical reality, but the language that's used to express it didn't come along until later. And so the term original sin didn't exist in her day. And so without that, you wouldn't be able to say to yourself, well, I'm free of original sin. But presumably Mary would have had a very strong sense of, I don't want to betray God. You know, I want to mm-hmm. be as close to him as I can. Just the thought of sinning, it just turns me away from that. That's repugnant to me. I don't want to do that. I'm dead set against that. I want to be pure and holy and devoted to God, and I want to do that with all of my being. And so she presumably would have had that kind of ability to articulate her experience as an immaculately conceived person, and she wouldn't obviously have any memory of ever having sinned or having, you know, felt differently than that. I would assume that would be the kind of way she would have articulated this. You know, I want to be the spotless, pure virgin of God that I aspire to be.
Thank you, Philip. And thanks again to everybody watching on YouTube Live, Facebook Live, or Periscope. We go to Nina in Hermosa Beach, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Nina, you are on with Jimmy Akin. What's your question?
Yes, my question is regarding this is connected with abortion, and how God chooses the organism to place a soul in to the body.
Okay.
Must lifeless organism, and he picks one of the little organisms that's produced by the through the marriage act through the month. Mm-hmm. He picks one of these little organisms and places a soul in it, and then upon abortion, there must sadly this might have influenced someone who's thinking about abortion, and it helped them to decide against it, hopefully. But
what's your question, ma'am?
The trauma that happens in abortion to the baby, we know about that, but we never talk about what trauma takes place upon when the soul and the body are separated mm-hmm. on abortion.
Okay.
Did you want Jimmy to comment on that?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I guess I'd say a few things here. The first one is we want to clarify when the human soul appears. It wasn't clear to me from the description. It sounded like you were talking about like the ova that a mother releases, and then they're fertilized as a result of the sexual act. It's not always a conjugal act because unmarried people do this as well, although they shouldn't. God doesn't take either a sperm or an ovum and give that a soul. Then those are both living. They're not dead. There's no point in here where these are dead. They're living cells that then come together and merge into a human being, a one-celled human being that has a complete human genetic code. It's a complete organism. If you leave it alone, it's going to grow and become an adult human organism. But since the soul is the form of the human body, not its shape, but the life principle that enables it to continue to grow and develop and so forth as a living human, that soul is present at the moment of conception, at the moment of fertilization. And so or at least as soon as the fertilization is complete, you have – the technical term is a zygote, and that zygote has a human soul. It's a one-celled human being at that point. Now, abortions typically are performed at a later stage in pregnancy. We don't really have the ability to go in after a zygote at present, thank God. But we do have the ability to, in one way or another, cause at a later stage the child to be aborted. And at some stages of pregnancy, that's very painful. Especially if it's done later in pregnancy when the child already has a fully developed nervous system that's, you know, able to feel pain. And we can see evidence of that from videos of children experiencing pain in the womb. And we know from cases of miscarriage and so forth where there have been autopsies, they have the neurology to feel pain. And so during the abortion procedure itself, it can be quite painful for the child depending on the stage at which the child is aborted. In terms of its soul and what the soul experiences, here we have to be a little more careful because we don't know a lot about what happens with the souls of children in this situation. We know that they go into the hands of a merciful God. We know that they're not going to experience, you know, eternal suffering through no fault of their own. But exactly what happens is a little unclear. God hasn't told us that much about it. And so I would personally be hesitant to say that after an abortion, the soul of the child in the intermediate state feels trauma. Because for all I know, God has taken that soul to be with him in heaven, and the child is experiencing beatitude in heaven. And now, that doesn't mean the child doesn't recognize the injustice that was done, because the child should have been allowed to live a full human lifespan and not be killed in the womb. So the child clearly in that case would recognize the injustice. But whether they would feel it traumatically is another question. It's like if you have someone who's martyred, as an adult, well, if they're with God in heaven, they know the injustice that was done to them when they were martyred. But they're not suffering, they're not traumatized in heaven as a result of that martyrdom. And this is kind of an analogous case. Now, that doesn't mean we can't depict this injustice in along those lines, there's a passage in the book of Revelation where the Lamb is unsealing the seals on the scroll in heaven. And when he removes one of the seals, the souls of the martyrs under the altar in heaven cry out to God for justice. And in the same way, because they were unjustly killed. And in the same way, we could imagine the souls of the unborn who have been killed by abortion, crying out to God for justice. But whether they would literally be traumatized is another matter, and I personally would leave that up to God because he hasn't given us a lot of information in this area. This is still a mystery. We'll have to find out some of these answers when we're on the other side ourselves.
Thank you, Nina. Let's see if we can get Kelsey in Colorado in before we go. Kelsey, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Go ahead, Kelsey. Sorry.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm doing a research paper on the growing culture of death.
Okay.
I'd like to know what the
Catholic
position is on physician-assisted suicide.
Okay. The Catholic position is that physician-assisted suicide is intrinsically evil. It is always intrinsically wrong to kill an innocent human being. And to put doctors in the position of killing their patients is something that is evil in and of itself. Doctors should be ministers of healing, not of death. And consequently, rather than killing their patients, they should seek better solutions. Now, there are many situations where people are in great pain, but the solution is not to kill the patient. The solution is to help with the pain and to give patients the kind of pain relief that they need. This is something that we're very fortunate today. We have very excellent and effective ways of relieving pain. And fundamentally, we should seek to alleviate the suffering of patients so that they don't want to kill themselves, because that's not the solution here. We're not masters of our own lives. They're not simply things we can dispose of. And it's fundamentally inhumane when you say that, and it's a loss for all of humanity, and it's not compassionate to say that the solution to a medical problem is killing the patient. That's contrary to the medical profession and the mission of medical professionals. It's also contrary to the dignity of the patients themselves, because if a patient has been reduced by suffering to a position where the patient wants to kill himself or herself, then we've already passed the point where there's been a failure. And the solution is to undo that failure by relieving the person's sufferings so that they no longer have that desire. They no longer feel that desperate that they want to end their life in order to end their suffering. If you'd like to read more about this, there's some discussion of it at the website of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Just go to usccb.org. That's for United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, usccb.org, and type in physician-assisted suicide. There will be information there. We also have some at catholic.com. There's a lot of easily accessible information on the web for your research paper, and good luck with it.
And thank you very much, Kelsey, for that call. Next hour, we have open forum once again. Tom Nash will be in here to take your questions. Well, I shouldn't say we'll be in here. We'll be joining us via Skype to take your questions on any aspect of the life of the church.
He'll be here in the virtual space of the show.
He will, indeed. Yeah. You occupied the virtual space very well today.
Thank you. I also occupied the physical space.
Not quite as well.
Studio.
But
thank you. I have lost weight. So,
yes,
yeah.
You're occupying less physical space. Yeah. This is Cy Gillett. This is Catholic Answers Live. The number 888-318-7884. If you have a question, we're still taking questions on any aspect of the life or faith of the Catholic Church. When we come back, more open forum on Catholic Answers Live.